it's an important one to think about when we talk about the antidepressant thing. If antidepressants cause mass shootings, would we want to know that? Of course we would. Why wouldn't we want to know that? There is no such evidence at this time. And this is Alex Jones level stuff. Alex Jones has talked about that. Others have talked about it, again, as part of this concerted effort to talk about everything other than guns when it comes to mass shootings. We have a tremendous bonus show for you today. Producer Pat is back from Hawaii. He will tell us, did he see Tulsi Gabbard while there? And also, what was he up to? I am very curious to hear about it. I've never been to the 50th state of the United States, but I would love to go. We're going to hear from Pat. We will also talk about a growing problem in the United States that in many other parts of the world is not really a problem. The lack of public restrooms, including in our very own New York City. Okay, we will talk about all of that and more on the bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Well, easy there. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You'll get access to the bonus show. You can use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to get a discount. And we will.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The whole nation should understand and have a level of empathy to understand that this can happen anywhere, in any peace-loving community.
7 dead in the Highland Park massacre, including the parents of a 2-year-old child shielded by his dad's body. The high-powered rifle used in the attack was bought legally. This despite the fact the gunman, 21 years old, rapped obsessively about mass murder online, posting violent videos, including one that seems to show the parade route he targeted. We'll talk about what we know about the shooter with Michael Edison Hayden of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He focuses on internet radicalization and far-right extremism. Then we go to Boston, where about 100 members of the white supremacist Patriot Front marched through downtown on Saturday. A black activist was attacked when he tried to film them.
I am appalled that even as a healer, I have to get my cup poured into in this incident. But in this incident, I will continue to pour into other people's cup as a way to pour into my own cup.
Then a new Supreme Court case threatens another body blow to our democracy. That's the headline of a Washington Post op-ed co-authored by Carolyn Shapiro, former law clerk to the now retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
We know that even at the founding, there were state constitutions limiting what state legislatures could do with respect to federal elections, and that was seen as completely normal.
It's been called a judicial coup in process. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Highland Park, Illinois, the death toll in Monday's mass shooting at the city's July 4th parade has risen to 7. The dead include a married couple, Irina and Kevin McCarthy, who attended the parade with their 2-year-old son, Aiden, who was found wandering alone after the shooting. The boy's father died as he tried to protect his son from the rooftop sniper who fired 70 rounds at parade goers. 9 shooting victims remain hospitalized. On Tuesday, authorities filed 7 counts of first-degree murder against the suspected gunman, a 21-year-old resident of Highland Park named Robert Cremo. Police also acknowledged they visited the man's house twice in 2019. First, after his family said he tried to take his own life by suicide, and then when he threatened to, quote, kill everyone. This is Chris Covelli, a spokesperson for the Lake County Sheriff's Office.
The second occurred in September of 2019. A family member reported that Cremo said he was going to kill everyone, and Cremo had a collection of knives. The police responded to his residence. The police removed 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword from Cremo's home. At that time, there was no probable cause to arrest. There were no complaints that were signed by any of the victims. The Highland Park Police Department, however, did immediately notify the Illinois State Police of the incident.
Police say over the next 3 years, the gunman legally purchased 5 firearms, even though the Illinois State Police had been notified about the police visits. On Tuesday, Vice President Kamala Harris visited Highland Park. She also addressed the National Education Association convention in Chicago, where she called on Congress to renew the assault weapons ban.
There is no reason that we have weapons of war on the streets of America. We need reasonable gun safety laws.
In reproductive rights news, Mississippi's near total ban on abortion is set to go into effect on Thursday.
after a judge rejected a challenge by Mississippi's only abortion clinic, Jackson Women's Health Organization. Meanwhile, Florida's 15-week abortion ban has been reinstated after it was temporarily blocked Tuesday by a state judge. A grand jury in Georgia probing Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the state's 2020 election has subpoenaed seven Trump advisors and allies, including Rudy Giuliani, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, and the attorneys John Eastman and Jenna Ellis. The Fulton County District Attorney launched the probe after the Washington Post reported Trump had called Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on January 2, 2021, and urged him to, quote, find 11,780 votes. Meanwhile, the House January 6 committee has announced it will hold its next hearing on Tuesday, July 12th at 10 a.m. Eastern. The hearing's expected to look in part at the far-right groups that attacked the U.S. Capitol at the urging of former President Trump. Democracy Now! Will live stream that July 12th hearing at democracynow.org. In news from Ukraine, the governor of the eastern province of Donetsk has urged more than 350,000 residents to evacuate as Russian forces attack areas across the region. Russia's focusing its assault on Donetsk after taking full control of the neighboring Luhansk region. The two areas make up what's known as the Donbas region. Residents in Donetsk have reported coming under intense shelling.
They're shelling everywhere now, but I don't really want to leave my home behind. I have a child. I hope someday this will stop. I hope for peace. I hope they stop shelling, that we can move around the city calmly, walk around, and go to the sea one day.
In other news from Ukraine, the Wall Street Journal reports the Russian military is turning Ukraine's largest nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia into a military base by deploying heavy artillery batteries and laying anti-personnel landmines. Officials say Russia is using the nuclear plant as a base for its artillery, knowing that Ukraine can't attack a nuclear power plant without risking a nuclear disaster. Zaporizhia is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson suffered another major political setback Tuesday when two senior cabinet ministers resigned, Finance Minister Rishi Sunak and Health Secretary Sajid Javid. The resignations came as Johnson faces increasing criticism for promoting a member of the Conservative Party who was accused of groping two men. On Tuesday, a Downing Street spokesperson admitted Johnson had been briefed in 2019 about the sexual abuse allegations, but claimed he had forgotten about the complaints. A growing economic crisis and gas shortage in Sri Lanka has forced the nation to keep its schools shut for another week because there is not enough gas for students and teachers to travel to school. Authorities have also announced plans to cut electricity by up to 3 hours a day because the country does not have enough fuel. Sri Lanka is also facing a dire shortage of food and medicine. On Tuesday, Sri Lanka announced it'll stop printing money as inflation is expected to reach 60% this year. The Israeli military conducted large-scale raids across the occupied West Bank today, detaining at least 42 Palestinians. Israeli forces shot dead a 20-year-old man named Rafiq Riyad Ghanem during a raid in the village of Jabba near Jenin. This comes just 3 days after Israeli forces shot dead 18-year-old Palestinian Kamel Awana in the same village. In Europe, police in at least five countries have arrested about 130 suspects accused of being involved in smuggling people across the English Channel to the United Kingdom. Raids were conducted Tuesday in Germany, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and the UK. This is Marco Ellermann, a police spokesperson in the German city of Osnabrück.
Hundreds of police and special forces have been in action this morning in many countries, not just in Germany, but also in Belgium, France, the Netherlands, and Great Britain. The aim of these raids was to counteract the international human trafficking ring and to disrupt it.
In Turkey, police fired tear gas and pepper spray at an LGBTQ plus pride march Tuesday in Ankara. At least 36 people were arrested. Last week, Turkish authorities broke up a larger pride march, detaining more than 350 people. In news from Ecuador, President Guillermo Lasso has accepted the resignation of four cabinet ministers in the latest fallout from last month's indigenous-led protest decrying Lasso's economic policies. The resignations include Lasso's economic and health ministers. In Washington, D.C., the Justice Department has agreed to a $98,000 settlement with a group of six Muslim, Arab, and South Asian men who were rounded up after the September 11th attacks and held in federal custody at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. As part of the settlement, the director of the Bureau of Prisons wrote a letter to the men acknowledging they were, quote, held in excessively restrictive and unduly harsh conditions of confinement. The letter also admitted a number of the men were physically and verbally abused by officers at the jail. The agreement settles a lawsuit brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. And a federal judge in California has thrown out Trump-era changes that weaken the Endangered Species Act by allowing regulators to factor in economic considerations when granting endangered status. The ruling came in a case brought by Earth Justice, the Sierra Club, and conservation groups. An attorney for the Sierra Club said, quote, in the midst of a global extinction crisis, the court's decision to vacate the rules will help ensure that imperiled species receive the protections they desperately need. Unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Residents of Highland Park, Illinois, are mourning the now seven victims of the July 4th parade mass shooting when a gunman climbed onto a rooftop and opened fire with an assault rifle similar to an AR-15, spewing more than 70 rounds at people watching the parade. The dead include a married couple, Irina and Kevin McCarthy, who attended the parade with their 2-year-old son, Aiden, who was found wandering alone after the shooting and smeared in blood. He was later reunited with his grandparents, who will now care for him. He was protected under the body of his father. On Tuesday, County Coroner Jennifer Bannock shared the names of those who were killed.
It is with a heavy heart that I bring to you the names of the victims of that tragedy. 64-year-old Catherine Goldstein of Highland Park, 35-year-old Irina McCarthy of Highland Park, 37-year-old Kevin McCarthy of Highland Park, 63-year-old Jacqueline Sundheim of Highland Park, 88-year-old Stephen Strauss of Highland Park, 78-year-old Nicholas Toledo Zaragoza of Morelos, Mexico. We have also been notified that there is a seventh victim that died at a hospital located outside of Lake County.
Some 40 others were injured in the attack. The suspected gunman, 21-year-old Robert Cremo, surrendered to police hours after the attack and had another rifle in his car. On Tuesday, he was charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder and is appearing in court today. Vice President Kamala Harris visited Highland Park Tuesday, called for an assault weapons ban.
There is no question that this experience is something that is going to linger in terms of the trauma. And so I'd like to urge all the families and all the individuals to seek the support that you so rightly deserve. And we'll deal with what we need to deal with in terms of also as we move forward, all agreeing that we got to be smarter as a country in terms of who has access to what, and in particular assault weapons. And we got to take this stuff seriously as you are, because you have been forced to have to take it seriously. The whole nation should understand and have a level of empathy to understand that this can happen anywhere, in any peace-loving community, and we should stand together and speak out about why it's got to stop.
Officials say the rifle the killer used in his attack was purchased legally. During a news conference, a spokesperson for the Lake County Sheriff's Office, Chris Covelli, acknowledged the suspect had come under previous police attention in 2019.
April of 2019, an individual contacted Highland Park Police Department a week after learning of Mr. Cremo attempting suicide. This was a delayed report, so Highland Park still responded to the residents a week later, spoke with Cremo, spoke with Cremo's parents, and the matter was being handled by mental health professionals at that time. There was no law enforcement action to be taken. It was a mental health issue handled by those professionals. The second occurred in September of 2019. A family member reported that Cremo said he was going to kill everyone, and Cremo had a collection of knives. The police responded to his residence. The police removed 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword from Cremo's home. At that time, there was no probable cause to arrest. There were no complaints that were signed by any of the victims.
Yet, months later, the suspected gunman bought five guns, two of them high-powered long guns, legally. Meanwhile, NBC News reports the suspected killer had a YouTube channel where he, quote, posted clips that telegraph violence, including one that appears to show the parade route that was targeted and another showing an animated shooting. At least two other videos show him supporting former President Donald Trump. The nonprofit media group Unicorn Riot also reports he had a Discord chat channel where he and others discussed graphic violence. He was obsessed with mass shootings. At a news conference Tuesday in Highland Park, the Lake County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Chris Covelli addressed the role of social media in the shooting.
So the question is essentially, social media, if we had known about some of the posts, would we have investigated? Do we encourage the community to report those? And the answer is absolutely. If the public sees something that is concerning online with anybody, they should notify the social media network it's posted on. They should notify local law enforcement. And that's when we get involved and we conduct an investigation.
For more, we're joined by Michael Edison Hayden, senior investigative reporter with the Southern Poverty Law Center, where he focuses on internet radicalization and also far-right extremism. I'm actually sorry that you're back on the show, Michael Edison Hayden, that we need to have you to talk about yet another shooting, well over 300 mass shootings this year in the United States, the U.S. alone in the world. And yet in this case, unlike in the Uvalde case in Texas, it was so clear the shooter's obsession with violence, with school shootings, with mass murder. Michael Edison Hayden, take us through this life online. He had thousands of followers on YouTube. Explain what Discord is, etc.
Thanks so much, Ian. So, this Highland Park massacre presents a kind of a different opportunity for us because it doesn't involve this white supremacist ideology that drove, for example, the Buffalo shooter. And we're able to look at it in a different way. It gives us a different angle on it. And, there are these fringe communities online, whether they're white supremacist or they're gore related in this case, where, people use the word meme and talking about a mimetic nature of the internet. Where you don't need the deep state to come in and radicalize you and put you on psychedelic drugs and get you to in a state where you're going to commit mass murder. People are volunteering for this, and they are subjecting themselves to people who are already in a and subjecting themselves to the same imagery over and over and over again, talking themselves into doing violence. Some people go through with it, and some people don't. The bottom line is that we're seeing the horrific tragedy that comes when people do.
Usual here, or maybe not unusual, is that you have the police at his house twice, once because he had threatened to take his own life, and then very soon after because he threatened to, quote, kill everyone. They take his knife collection, dagger, sword, many knives, but he isn't red flagged. And so there is no notice of this in any system in Illinois. His father sponsors him for guns, and he gets one after another, after another, after another, after another. He gets five guns.
Yeah. So, I mean, the center doesn't have a position to advocate here, but this is some very basic common sense stuff. I mean, do you want someone in a fragile mental state who has been subjecting themselves to murder memes online every day for months, owning weapons of war? I mean, I'm a father. I have two sons, Stephen Miller, for example, is a father of a child. Does he really want somebody like this in his neighborhood owning weapons of war? He may say he does, and that's the policy of the Republican Party. But when it comes to practicality, you know, do you want someone who has been subjecting themselves to this kind of, this kind of coaxing repeatedly, owning a weapon of war? I don't understand what society would tolerate this. It's obviously very frustrating. And then you talk about freedom. I mean, what is the freedom of the people who lost their lives at Highland Park, or people who lost their lives at this top supermarket in Buffalo?
So let me ask you about this report on NBC News that the shooter didn't frequently post about major political figures on his websites, except for two posts about former President Donald Trump. There's a picture of him at a rally and also wrapped in a Trump flag. A video posted to his YouTube page January 2nd, 2021, appears to show him among a throng of protesters cheering for Trump's presidential motorcade outside an airport. And then he also posted what he called a manifesto as an Amazon ebook, which consisted of 28 pages of numbers seemingly meant to be decoded. The ebook published in 2021, no longer available on Amazon, and the numbers of 47 and 23 seemed to be very important to him, tattooed some of it on his face.
Yeah, okay. So regarding the Trump thing, it's very interesting to me in some ways because it sort of lays bare the attraction of the hard right authoritarian movement that is brewing in the United States, because this person, according to all his friends or people who worked with him or knew him, that he was not like a particularly political person, but yet he appears around these Trump events, right? And the Parkland shooter was also kind of attracted to right wing, stuff online, but was not a particularly political. It didn't seem to be motivated by politics. A Vegas shooter, for example, also had some kind of murky connection to the right wing, but he didn't seem to be motivated by it. So you have these people who are programming themselves to kill and are, like, hyped up on killing, who are also attracted to the nihilism of hard right authoritarianism in the United States. And it really shows. I mean, it's not coincidental that there are all these themes of death and all these things around fascism. And it's just, I find it fascinating because this is not a political shooting at all. But yet here he is with this Trump flag. It's interesting because there's, all these apolitical shooters also seem to have some sort of connection to this.
Let me ask you about this report. After Monday's shooting, 4chan trolls invaded the community, using it as a meeting point to laud the shooter and post memes about the attack. The Discord channel was shut down around 6 p.m. Eastern on Monday, just hours after he was named as a person of interest. He also posted frequently to a message board that discussed graphic depictions of murder, suicide, and death. His most recent post last week, when he posted a video of a beheading. Now, I'm saying he, though we did name him in this show so far. What about that as well? The celebration of the mass murderers, using their names, showing their pictures. How do you feel about showing them or not? Now, they put out his picture and his name constantly on Monday because they were looking for him. Apparently, he was dressed as a woman to disguise especially his facial tattoos when he actually carried out the shooting, blended in with the crowd, went to his mom's house. Mom and dad live separately. He lives with his father. Got the car, went to Wisconsin, came back, and was found right in the next community because of an alert person who called the police. Talk about all of this, and specifically whether the picture and the name should be repeated.
So I'm not using his name, using it sparingly. And we are, going to report, add anything we add from the Highland Park murders into reports that we do carefully, because we don't want to add to this guy's celebrity. He so obviously sought it, just in the same way the Buffalo shooter sought to be accepted and treated as a celebrity inside white supremacist communities, for example. Regarding the 4chan stuff, these are, in a colloquial sense, cyber Nazis. They are essentially just internet fascists. Whether they're conscious of that, some of them are, or whether they're not, they're fascists. What attracts them to shooters, and they have been all over shooters for many years on 4chan, sadly, is they seek to disrupt the country. They seek to create chaos and division in the country, and shootings give us all this sense of grief and anxiety. We worry about our children. We worry about our loved ones. We feel horror for those who died, and we mourn. And they love those emotions because they like to feast on them, because they can use it to try to tilt the country towards fascism. And that's sort of just the way 4chan has worked, since the Obama years. And it's horrible. And these type of people are going to be online for a long time. The question is, what are we going to do about it, just in terms of mitigating this kind of these sporadic, actually not really sporadic, these frequent shootings?
Michael, we want to ask you to stay with us. We're going to move from the online presence of the shooter to what happened in Boston. We're speaking with Michael Edison Hayden. He is a senior investigative reporter with Southern Poverty Law Center. He focuses on internet radicalization and far-right extremism. Yes, next up, we're going to go to Boston, where about 100 members of the white supremacist Patriot Front marched through downtown on Saturday. A black activist artist was attacked when he simply put up his phone to film them. Stay with us. Freedom from Moon Cricket Songs by Boston-based composer and musician Charles Morrell at the Boston Center of the Arts Cyclorama on World AIDS Day last year. Charles Morrell was attacked Saturday by the Patriot Front, which we're going to talk about now. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Boston, where Mayor Michelle Wu joined federal officials Tuesday to respond to the march through downtown Boston Saturday, led by 100 members of the white supremacist Patriot Front, carrying shields and a banner that read, "Reclaim America." Officials claim the Boston Regional Intelligence Center had no warning they were coming. Local anti-fascist activists confronted the marchers. Mayor Wu also said the Boston Police Civil Rights Unit is investigating how Patriot Front members were seen attacking a local black artist and musician named Charles Morrell as police looked on. Charles Morrell posted online about the attack, writing, quote, "Just another day in the office." Yesterday, as I was walking to work, a group of white men wearing masks and holding military weapons were marching on the sidewalk. I was walking past the historic Copley Hotel. I thought it was odd that a protest was happening on the sidewalk and not the street. When I tried to get my phone to record the masked mob, this happened. See photos, he said. He went on, now fake bot accounts are in my DM and on my social media pages trying to instill fear into myself and community. I assume these are the same masked white men. I share this to first say things have not changed much. Secondly, this is why I do the work that I do with passion, Charles Morrell wrote. Charles is not doing interviews while he seeks legal advice, but he did speak out Monday.
I am appalled that even as a healer, I have to get my cup poured into in this incident. But in this incident, I will continue to pour into other people's cup as a way to pour into my own cup.
For more, we're joined by three guests. In Boston, Reverend Kevin Peterson, longtime civil rights activist, founder of the New Democracy Coalition, advisor to Charles Morrell, is with us. In Cambridge, Philip Martin, an award-winning journalist and senior investigative reporter for GBH News Center for Investigative Reporting, where he recently wrote a piece headlined, It's Happening Here. Massachusetts has a growing neo-Nazi movement. And still with us, Michael Edison Hayden, senior investigative reporter with the Southern Poverty Law Center, who focuses on internet radicalization and far-right extremism. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Reverend Peterson, let's begin with you. Explain, I'm sorry we can't have Charles Morrell on today, but you are his close friend and advisor. Can you tell us more about what happened on Saturday?
I'm not sure if I can tell you more about what happened beyond what you've already said, but we do know that Mr. Morrell is currently traumatized. He has a focus around racial healing in this city. He uses it through the arts. He believes that this is an opportunity where he can redirect the trauma that he experienced in terms of engaging these children of the KKK on Saturday, use that experience to engage the city, particularly Mayor Wu, in terms of changing things around, changing the narrative of the city. Boston is not unlike other places across the United States with regard to endemic racism. Boston was founded during the slave trade. The legacy of slavery and systemic oppression towards Black people persists even into 2022. Just 2 weeks ago, the Boston City Council apologized for its complicity in the slave trade and ongoing systemic oppression. Mr. Morrell's experience is reflective of that systemic oppression. This environment in Boston, I believe, provided a way through which, or rationale through which, these children of the KKK came into Boston to try to spew their toxin and their hate.
Reverend Peterson, how did the police respond? Where were they when Charles was being attacked?
Well, Mr. Merrill's narrative is that the police were in close proximity to him. And in fact, Mr. Morrell suggests that he engaged the police for help, but that help at that point wasn't forthcoming. So we have, at this point, different narratives coming from the administration, from the police, from Mayor Wu, and Mr. Morrell's account. I'm confident to say that I've had a number of conversations with Mr. Morrell, and he's clear that the police were present. He asked for help. The police officer, or one of them, claimed that they were overwhelmed and they couldn't respond to the assault that took place on him. That's disturbing. Even more disturbing is the fact that such an organized group of white supremacists, the children of the KKK, descended on the city and marched through the streets with brazen activity, unmonitored for the most part by law enforcement. It left thousands of Black citizens, of course, vulnerable to any kind of racial violence that they would have fostered. And in fact, Mr. Morrell became a victim of that racial balance.
And we're showing video from Twitter of these people who have like khaki pants, which of course reminds me of the University of Virginia Unite the Right rally, and dark shirts, either long sleeve or short sleeved, and then white masks over their faces and baseball caps. Philip Martin, you're with GBH News. You wrote an extended piece in May called It's Happening Here. Massachusetts has a growing neo-Nazi movement. Now, the mayor, Michelle Wu, said they had no idea these people were coming this weekend. But this is the third march this year. Explain how you see this movement growing. What's happening? Why Boston?
First of all, thank you for having me here, Amy. I find it, I'm a bit incredulous that the Boston of the mayor, others seem to have been taken by surprise. Granted that this was a demonstration, they should not have been surprised taking part in flash exits on freeways, holding banners over freeways, leaving graffiti everywhere, defacing Black Lives Matter signs across the state, including Brockton not long ago. There have been reported assaults by this group and a similar group, NSC 131, for a long time. And so I can see this as a, without question, they did not know about this, it seems. But to be taken by surprise, I'm incredulous over that. Given the growing activity of these organizations over the past few years, and you cited it correctly with the Unite the Right rally that you mentioned. That's where the Patriot Front began, by this individual Thomas Rousseau. And what's happening in Boston is not that dissimilar from what's happening around the country. But a unicorn riot, a treasure trove of documents revealed that Massachusetts, England. Are the areas that they consider prime recruiting grounds, despite the region's reputation for liberalism. As Reverend Peters was just pointing out, there are multiple contradictions that make their presence here the game in this community. Though there's also, I should point out, massive pushback against these groups, against Patriot Front, by people on the ground. Jewish organizations, Black organizations, anti-fascists, academics, others. So they are not getting a warm reception. Thus, the reason I believe they decided to descend on the area over the weekend. It gave them the attention they wanted. They are in competition with NSC 131, but also in collusion with them. NSC 131 has had a presence in the area. Protesting at Brigham and Women's Hospital in January, taking part in a demonstration at the St. Patrick's Day Parade in March, where they displayed a Boston is returned Boston to the Irish sign or something to that effect. And so, again, this, Amy, is something that has been taking place. It is a growing movement, growing as ascertained by observation from those who study fascism, that these are groups that had two or three people at rallies maybe a year ago, 3 years ago, and now are able to get get 30 people at rallies, people largely from this area. Though this 100 who had just on Boston over the weekend, without question, they came from various parts of the country, and it's believed that Thomas Rousseau was among them. Mm-hmm.
That Rousseau was among them, which brings me back to Michael Edison Hayden. Michael, you're with the Southern Poverty Law Center. We last had you on, giving us background on the Patriot Front. So talk more about who Rousseau is, how this group was founded, what it's doing, why in Boston, and before that, what, there are protests in Philadelphia, these historic American cities.
Michael. Phenomenon. I like that. Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, sure. You know, I like that phrase, children of the KKK. That was great. You know, I think that they are not the KKK yet, but they in its heyday. But boy, do they want to be. And, you know, there was a group called Vanguard America that marched at Unite the Right. And you may remember James Fields, who murdered Heather Heyer. He actually marched with that group, and they kind of rebranded under this veil of patriotism, and kind of to try to pull from the Republican Party shtick, and make a more marketable version of what is essentially neo-Nazism. And they've had some success at building a movement across the country. They've had people across the country. They have absolutely, been successful at doing these marches where there are about, anywhere between 30 and 100 people marching on the street. But yeah, they did something also on July 4th last year, or in the July 4th weekend, regarding, in Philadelphia, for example. They are picking these places that have historical importance in the United States. Their slogan is Reclaim America. And it's this idea of restoring America to their imagined past. This, certainly America does have a deeply racist past, but they envision this perfect version of the United States that is going to come from their activism. That's going to be essentially just a white supremacist ethnostate.
And how do they organize online?
Yeah, I mean, they're all over Telegram. They were using Discord. They are essentially building little cells across the country and communicating with each other this way. They don't often reveal their names to one another until, they get to know each other in person. They are trying to lock down their communications, but quite frankly, they've been poor at it. Because they are frequently getting ID'd by anti-fascist activists all over the country and also by our organization.
And their connection to January 6th, the Patriot Front members marching part of the President Trump's insurrection?
No, they are superficially anti-Trump. They're superficially anti-Republican Party, but they work kind of in tangent with the Republican Party in the sense that they run parallel to them. For people that believe that Trump is too cozy with Jewish people, the Patriot Front is there to kind of recruit you. It is there. They do essentially the same things there. You see Stephen Miller's America First Legal is going to be attacking all kinds of things that he describes as woke. What does that really mean? It's LGBTQ plus rights, right, stuff like, this critical race theory boogeyman that they keep trotting out, whatever else. It's the, sort of the same stuff that Patriot Front is talking about, but this is for people who are further along the line of radicalization and don't want to associate themselves with the Republican Party. But they absolutely work in tandem with them, and they run parallel to them.
And Philip Martin of GBH News, you report about this, that members were represented in D.C. during the insurrection.
That's right. This is, of course, before they rebranded themselves as Patriot Front. You had members of NSC 131 present.
What does NSC stand for?
Nationalist Social Club. And the 131 is alphanumeric code for anti-communism. They consider, of course, anyone anti-commun. They consider anyone communist, whether they be a liberal, a moderate, a so-called rhino within the Republican Party, people advocating for equality. The notion of communism they have incorporated into their talking points, in which they see anyone, again, who oppose fascism as communists. But they're neo-Nazis. They are described as a small army of neo-Nazis by both the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League. And so, yes, they started off in Charlottesville. They have Thomas Rousseau has attempted to grow this movement based on some of the grievances that were my colleague from Southern Poverty Law Center was just talking about. Within that have been amplified by the Republican Party, they have been amplified and animated by the so-called theory of and believing that that is something that people are, in fact, reacting to. And you can see some of the comments that appear on social media, where, in fact, here in Boston, you found individuals who were condemning the Patriot Front, but you also found comments on Twitter and Facebook. Folks were saying, well, what about the communists? What about the Democratic Party? What about the Antifa? What about Black Lives Matter? Where they basically try to create this false equivalency that these groups, the Patriot Front and others, are simply the flip side. And thus they have, and it's mythical. And the whole notion of the of both sidisms in the context of fascism. But anyway, the point here, I'm sorry, go on.
Philip, the role of the police, the Reverend describing, or actually Charles Morrell himself saying they didn't help him, and the mayor saying they had no idea this was happening. I think we're going to have, we will end it there.
We have to be incredulous of whether, if the police were nearby and they did nothing, that's a problem. If the police were not in proximity to where this man was being beaten, then that's a problem also. It means that they really weren't monitoring well this procession of neo-fascists through downtown Boston on 4th of July weekend.
And finally, Reverend Kevin Peterson, you know, a news conference was called with black leaders. You were among them.
Yes.
What are you calling for now?
Well, we're calling for a couple things. One is, as much as the police department is investigating what crime occurred, what civil rights were violated against Mr. Morrell, we're also calling for Boston, the police or the mayor, to conduct an internal investigation in terms of police activities on that day on site. Were there police present? We're asked for the release of videotape from Starbucks, which captured the incidents, and perhaps identify more succinctly if the police were present. We're asking for any body camera visuals that might be present. Beyond that, Amy, we're asking the mayor to take a deep dive into engaging in more robust conversations around race in a city that has been dogged by race for so long. Those pictures of Mr. Morrell are reflective of the racial legacy in the city of Boston that persists. Beyond the conversation, we also call for a race commission where the city of Boston will bring to fore the enormous resources in the city of Boston in terms of the academic and legal community to explore the legacy of racism up until 2022, provide information perhaps throughout the schools, but throughout the neighborhoods, of course, so that the residents of Boston can learn more. About what racism is and how it is impactful in its subtle and most obvious ways. And then we asked for the commission to look into what would constitute repair or reparations in the city of Boston. How do we address the historic wrongs fostered upon black people as it relates to the legacy of slavery and systemic oppression? How do we address those issues of unequal housing situations with relation to black? How do we address the unequal health morbidities? How do we address income inequality with regard to black and white in the city of Boston? Those things are enormous. They reflect an incredible gap in terms of how blacks maintain their lives in Boston against the privilege of white lives, or how whites are privileged.
Well,
so we asked for something comprehensive, something carefully thought through. We asked the mayor to move beyond the soothing words and apologies and get to some substantive policies and actions that brings Boston into the current situation where we're trying to address the issue of Reverend
Kevin
racism
Peterson,
in a more substantive way.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, founder of the New Democracy Coalition, speaking to us from Boston. Philip Martin, investigative reporter with GBH News, will link to your pieces. It's happening here. Massachusetts has a growing neo-Nazi movement, and your latest piece. And Michaela Edison Hayden with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Coming up, a new Supreme Court case threatens another body blow to our democracy. We'll speak with the former law clerk for the retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Yes, we'll speak with Carolyn Shapiro, professor. Stay with us. The Rising Sun by The Animals. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court announced Thursday it'll hear oral arguments in a case experts warn could be one of the greatest threats to U.S. democracy since the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. In October, the court will hear Moore v. Harper, a case which seeks to reinstate gerrymandered congressional maps that were struck down by North Carolina's highest court. A ruling in favor of North Carolina Republicans could strip state courts of their power to strike down state laws while expanding the power of GOP-controlled state legislatures to control federal elections. Legal arguments brought forward by plaintiffs in Moore v. Harper could drastically alter how congressional and presidential elections are conducted. At the heart of the case, a theory known as ISLT, that's Independent State Legislature Doctrine, which the Supreme Court's repeatedly rejected for well over a century. But the theories gained support in the new majority conservative court. Justices Neil Gorsuch, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Brett Kavanaugh have all endorsed different versions of this doctrine. The three liberal justices have signaled they will not overrule the Supreme Court's many precedents rejecting the doctrine. This means the fate of the case could rest in the hands of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Just one day before the Supreme Court agreed to hear Moore v. Harper, it ruled 6-3 to reinstate a Republican-drawn congressional map in Louisiana struck down by a lower court as a racially motivated violation of the Voting Rights Act. New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, quote, "We are witnessing a judicial coup in process. If the president and Congress do not restrain the court now, the court's signaling they will come for the presidential election next," unquote. For more, we're joined by Carolyn Shapiro, professor of law and director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States at Chicago-Kent College of Law, co-authored the recent Washington Post op-ed headlined "A New Supreme Court Case Threatens Another Body Blow to Our Democracy." She is a former clerk to the now-retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Professor Shapiro, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you just start off by laying out the significance of the court taking up this case and what you're most concerned about? If you could start again I think you're muted. If you could start again. No, don't hear you. Oh, I think
you hear me now.
Yes, we hear you now. Go ahead.
I'm so sorry. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Sorry for the glitch. The case is very important. In 2019, when the Supreme Court said that extreme partisan gerrymandering claims couldn't be heard by federal courts, it's in a 5-4 decision, it said, that's okay, don't worry, there are other ways to challenge extreme partisan gerrymandering, and one of those ways is through state constitutions. That's exactly what happened in Moore versus Harper, and now the Republican legislators who drew this map at that dramatically skews in a congressional delegation in favor of Republicans are suing and saying that, in fact, the state constitution and the state courts don't have the power to limit partisan gerrymandering or, for that matter, to in any other way constrain legislatures when they regulate federal elections. So this could open the door to a host of problems. It eliminates the kinds of ordinary checks and balances that we expect courts and constitutions to place on legislatures.
Tell us who Moore is.
So Moore is one of the Republican leaders of the North Carolina state legislature. And North Carolina has a law that allows him and some of his colleagues to intervene in this case and to bring this lawsuit. What they want to be able to do is to draw maps for the congressional districts that the North Carolina Supreme Court has already said violate the North Carolina Constitution. Normally, state legislatures can't do things that violate their state constitutions, but this ISLT, or independent state legislature theory, says that they do have the power to do that when it comes to regulating federal elections. The reason for that has to do with the language in two clauses of the Constitution that give state legislatures the responsibility and the power to regulate federal elections. But nothing in the federal Constitution suggests that they get to do that free of the ordinary limitations of state constitutions.
So explain this in practical terms. Are we talking about federal elections and state elections? You have to deal with them separately in each state? How do people vote?
This is a great question, and it is one of the really big problems with the ISLT. What it suggests is that a state legislature could pass a single law that governs federal and state elections, which is what happens in most states, and that if a state court finds that some aspect or all of that statute to be unconstitutional under the state constitution, it still has to apply to federal elections. So you might find yourself, a state might find itself with two registration systems or two different mail-in deadlines for absentee ballots, all depending on the particular state constitutional issues that the state court rules on. This makes less than no sense as a matter of separation of powers. It doesn't make any sense as a matter even of imagining what a legislature might have intended when it passes a single law governing both state and federal elections. So it could cause enormous chaos. It also opens the door to a kind of mischief, or mischief is an understatement. It gives the state legislatures the power to do things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And so they could pass laws that govern just federal elections that are extremely problematic from the perspective of democracy. They could draw, for example, as in North Carolina, incredibly gerrymandered congressional districts. They could even potentially create systems in which a state legislature gets to resolve any disputes over election results in federal elections, which would include presidential elections. And we could imagine what that might look like down the road. It could be extremely dangerous. Much of that, if not all of it, would be unconstitutional under many, if not all, state constitutions. But under the ISLT, that wouldn't matter.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds. How does this relate to the Voting Rights Act?
Well, they're both the Voting Rights Act and the ISLT, or a movement against the ISLT, are ways of trying to protect voting, protect the power of the people to choose their own representatives. And in those cases, as in others, the Supreme Court, the majority, continues to cut back on protections for voting and protections for democracy. It's extremely dangerous.
And again, ISLT stands for something you'll be hearing much more of with this court, the independent state legislature theory. And we want to thank Professor Carolyn Shapiro, Professor of Law and Director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology. We'll link to your piece in the Washington Post. A new Supreme Court case threatens another body blow to our democracy. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
RCT in sound from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. You've probably had this experience. You're waiting for a bus, and you keep waiting, and you keep waiting, and other buses go past that aren't going to the destination that you want, and you keep waiting, and then three buses show up, and they're all going to the same place you were planning to go.
Yes. Thank you, New York City MTA, which always seemed to be the problem there.
Well, did you know that there's a term for this?
It's bunching or something, isn't it? I forget.
That's what it is. I should have known that you would know the transportation jargon. Yes, it's called bus bunching or banana bus.
Banana bus? What? Why is it called banana bus?
Because it's a bunch.
It's a bunch.
Yeah, and other terms for this are clumping or convoying or piggybacking or platooning, but it refers to a group of two or more vehicles, like buses or trains that are running along the same route, and they're supposed to be evenly spaced, but then one of them gets delayed, and it messes up everything. And it's just, I've been spending a little time, of course, looking at how transportation analysts try to figure out how to make that not happen.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so do you have the second and the third buses past the first? Because the first one picks up more passengers, so it's going to be slower loading and unloading, right?
Right, right.
Or if it's slowed down by picking up, say, someone in a wheelchair or just doesn't make it through a light in time too many times. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, and then more people show up and hop on that bus, and that means that for the next bus, there are fewer people, so it's going even faster.
Right. It can just sail by some stops because there's nobody waiting and nobody wants to get off.
So shout out to all of you who are working to prevent bus bunching.
And shout out to our Lingua Bunch. We're a show about language, and we like to talk about anything related to language, whether it's grammar, new words, slang, old words, stuff that the family says, stuff that the kids brought home, or a word that we need that English just doesn't seem to have. And if you're a second language speaker of English, we'd like to talk to you too. What's the big mystery of English that you really had to get your mind around? Let us know. 877-929-9673. Or explain it and tell us your thoughts in email, words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Mary. I'm in Alexandria, Virginia, stone's throw from George Washington's home.
Yeah, what would you like to talk with us about, Mary?
Sometime in the recent past, I, on Zoom, watched a presentation on ageism, and my mind has been chewing that topic up like a dog with a bone. And I've become more and more aware of the euphemisms that we use to avoid using the word old. The one word that made me contact you is the word senior, because we say senior citizens. Mm-hmm. So I went to the dictionary to see what the dictionary says. Well, the first two definitions are like in school or rank. The last one is elderly. And so my question is, has that third definition always been there, or is it connected with the fact that we now use the euphemism senior citizen?
Oh, what a great topic you've opened up, Mary. There's lots and lots to say about this. So how do you feel about it?
Now that I'm aware of it, I'm making changes in how I see myself and how I react to other people. When they say to me, oh, 80 is the new 60, I say, well, this is the new 80.
I like that. I like that a lot.
And when the topic of old comes up, I say, you know what? If you're lucky, you'll get old.
Exactly, right? Yeah, I like that. This is what 80